You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Meet the Farmers. And this, the third episode in the mini-series of my trip up to Scotland. In this episode, I visit the Burgess family on their farm near Galashiels. It's a diversified dairy farm. I sat down with Martin, Sheila, their son Ross, who is over from New Zealand. Lucy, who runs the ice cream side of the business, was busy making ice cream. And Sandy, Martin and Sheila's other son, was out on the farm. But this is a true family business. I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to episode 20 of Meet the Farmers. And welcome once again to the Scottish Borders. I'm really pleased to be here with Martin Burgess on the farm, where I actually lambed my first ever ewe several years back. Overlangshaw Farm is a truly diversified organic family dairy business. The herd includes Swedish Reds, Montbéliards and Danish breeds alongside your traditional black and white Frisians. The Burgess family also keep a flock of Clen ewes and a flock of free-range Colombian blacktail hens for eggs. On top of all that, milk is processed on-site to make ice cream, which is sold from a rather unique police box in Edinburgh. There's far more to it than that, which I'm sure we'll go into. But yeah, Martin, thank you for being such a good sport and agreeing to doing this, representing the family. There's a lot going on here at Overlangshaw, but I want to take each part of the business in turn, sort of to start with, probably, to give listeners an idea of how it all works. But let's start by talking about, if you can talk about how you came to the farm here in the first place. We're about 800 feet or so above sea level here.
Yeah.
When did you move here and what attracted you to the place?
We moved here in 1984. I'm a first generation farmer. My father was an engineer, built fishing boat engines. He got made redundant. I'd always wanted to farm for some reason. We managed to buy a hill farm on the west coast of Scotland. It was actually a good hill farm, but it was a hill farm for all that. We farmed there for about 14, 16 years, I think it was. My mother and father and I were in partnership. They wanted to retire, and we had to find some money for them to retire. So we sold up to a neighbour who was very keen to buy the place, and we got a very good price at the time. So we were looking around for farms. We didn't really have any specific notion where we wanted to go. And we got a bit fed up. We spent a summer staying in our my brother-in-law's house, and we got a bit fed up waiting. And there was quite a few farms on the borders for sale, quite a few farms on the borders in Aberdeenshire. So we plumped for the borders. We quite liked this place. Put an offer in and got it. It's just as simple as that, really.
And what did it look like? What was here when you took it on?
Well, it was, much as it was at the moment, quite a different type of farm to the one we had. West of Scotland's got a lot of foliage, you know, it's got a lot of bracken, that sort of stuff, where this was actually quite bare, not an awful lot of shelter. It had a dairy on it, but it had only just put the dairy on. And quotas had come in that year in 84, on the 1st of April, I think it was. And the fellow that had the farm had been hoping for a large quota, and he got a bit of a measly quota, and he just got fed up and he sold the place. We had no intention of milking cows when we came here. I'd milked cows at college. My wife, who had a farm in Argyll, they had actually had a wee milk run down at Colin Tryve. They milked 8-10 cows and delivered the milk. And so actually my wife knew more about milking cows than I did. But it had a quota, the place. When we came here, the quota was in the price of the farm, because quotas only at 4, 5, 6 months old, they had no value at all then. So my wife said, well, maybe we should use this quota. You know, it might be worthwhile. So we thought, well, all right, we'll give it a go. So we looked for cows in, I don't know, Farmers Weekly. I think I found a herd of cows down in Dartford in Kent. Yeah. So I went down, had a look at the cows. Cows were fine. We brought them up. I didn't quite know how I was going to do the job, but the dairyman was being made redundant there. So I said to the owner, do you think the dairyman would maybe come up for a week or two? He said, I'm sure he would, you can try him. So I asked the boy and he said, aye, he's fine. So he came up actually on one of the floats with the cows.
Yeah.
And we had him for about 3 or 4 weeks and he was absolutely brilliant. He showed me what to do, he knew all the cows, and quite honestly, without him, I would have been struggling. Hmm. So that's how we started. That's how we started milking cows.
So today, in the centre of everything, you're really a dairy farm milking a mix of different breeds. Tell me more about the herd. What size is the herd now, and how much milk are you producing?
The herd's about 115 cows now total. I think there's 97, 98 going through the parlour at the moment. We're on 6,600 litres, I think, annually we're on. It's come up a bit since we went organic. Since we've got into the routine of going organic, anyway, we went organic in 2001. We're quite happy with, it's a fairly low-cost system. We're quite happy with that. We managed to keep our back-to-scan and our cell counts under control. We get all the bonuses that are going for that. So it works reasonably well. My son, Sandy, who really runs the place now, he's in charge of that. He's actually putting a new milking parlour on this year, starting
very shortly. As we speak, almost.
Yes, as we speak. Yes.
You converted the farm to organic production at the turn of the millennium. Why did you decide to go down the organic line, and are you still as committed to it today as you were when you started?
Well, start with the latter question. We are still as committed, yes. There's no way. I don't, even if the premiums for organic produce stopped, I can't really see us ever going back to. I mean, the amount of fertiliser I must have wasted over the years. Horrific to think about it, really. You know, we don't miss that at all. Our grass comes the same time of year as our neighbours. We cut as much silage as our neighbours. I see no point in looking backwards. One or two things are amiss. We have a bit of a docking problem, which it would be nice to be able to spray, but I can remember spraying Dawkins before and getting what they thought was a very good kill, and 2 or 3 years later they were just back. So you've got to try and find different ways of managing that, you know.
Tell me about the egg business.
Eggs, right. We started that about 15 years ago.
Must have been.
The egg business. We were looking for something that didn't take up an awful lot of room and looked like it might be, we could handle it and it might be another income stream. And there were, at that time, there was a push on, people wanted organic eggs and there was an encouragement to put on sheds. So we put on a shed, a 2,000 bird shed, and we got into it quite quickly, actually. It was working quite well. So the trouble with just the one shed is, obviously, your hens are laying for about 70, 76 weeks, and then you maybe have 10 weeks without eggs, because you've got to have a clean out and then your new hens 3 or 4 weeks before they start laying. So if you get suppliers, you miss out on that length of period. And, well, suppliers, the people that we sell eggs, sometimes they say, well, we'll need to find somewhere else, obviously, and you don't get them back. So ideally, the shot was to get another shed and have them laying at a different time, so we continuity of supply. So that's what we have now. We've 2 sheds of 2,000 birds apiece. There was talk we'd put another shed on, but I think we've got enough on our plate at the moment, anyway.
Yeah. And the clean ewes?
The cleans, aye. Yes, we did have about 350, 400 ewes. We've cut that down a bit because we did have grazing at Lauder, which was about 8 or 9 miles away. We had that for about 10 years we used to put our ewes over in the summer. Well, we lost that, and we did look around for suitable other grazings, but there was nothing close enough that was going to be handy. So we've actually cut the ewes down. We're about 240 cleans now. And yes, they do a job. It would be difficult, more difficult to run the place without them, that's for sure. Sometimes in the spring things are pretty tight, you know, you're waiting for cows to get grass and you're waiting for silage fields, and as my wife complains, that the ewes are put onto the poorer pastures, which is probably right enough, but they survive and yes, they do away.
And finally, we can't speak about Overlandshaw without talking about ice cream. And it's currently sold throughout Edinburgh and the borders, including from Lucy's iconic police box at the Grass Market in Edinburgh. How much of the milk's going towards the ice cream?
Just about 3 or 4%, quite honestly, Ben.
This is proper added value.
Yes. They'll process 200 litres in a day, in a good day, and it used to just be a day and a half, but that's up to maybe 3 days a week now, you know, so that it is increasing. She put in a 20-litre batch machine this year, which replaced the 10-litre batch. So, yes, it is ongoing. Yes, definitely it's an expanding part of the farm, you know, and there is a lot more room for expansion. You know?
How long have you been making ice cream here for?
2007, Lucy tells us. It was my wife's idea. We did think that it might be quite a good thing to go into. And Lucy had left college. She was actually in New Zealand at the time. And we thought it would be a good wee job for her, whether she liked it or not. Because they were keen to come back and work on the place, you know. So she came back and she got into it. And she's taking it forward. She's actually very good at that, because she's much more outgoing than the rest of the family. She could sell ice creams to the Eskimos, you know. It's just
absolutely,
it's a knack she has. She's very lucky. So it's worked well. It's her business. She runs the whole thing.
But certainly what is evident, I suppose what I'm getting to here, which we were, before we started recording, we were alluding to as well, this is a proper family business. So you're fortunate to have the whole family very much hands-on, and you're able to plan for the future, but that's not the case for all family farms in Scotland and across Britain more broadly. In England last year, there was a report published from Campaign to Protect Rural England, which suggested that actually as many as 1 in 5 farm units has disappeared in the past 10 years as farms have merged and got bigger. Would you say that the future is still bright for the family farm in Scotland?
Well, it's bright in that if the family are keen, and most of the ones that have come back are keen, if they want to diversify and do different things, and most of them do, most of them are far more outward looking than the older generation, you know, I think there is. I would be quite hopeful. General agriculture, well, I don't need to tell anybody here, it is more difficult to deal with. You know, it's the cost of production goes up, your end price doesn't really go up. I mean, we're selling calves, just as an instance here, for not a lot more off the cow at 2 or 3 weeks old than we were when we came here 30 years ago. You know, it's unbelievable that. But overall, I'm quite hopeful that the family farm will survive, maybe in a slightly smaller quantity than it is at the moment, certainly.
Would you have stayed in dairy farming if you hadn't diversified into the ice cream, or was it a bonus on top?
Well, it was a bonus on top. If we hadn't been, or if we'd stayed conventional rather than organic, we wouldn't have survived. Certainly would not have survived. Absolutely no chance. But the organic price has always been a bit. We waited 8 or 9 years to get a decent price, but since then, supply has been supply and demand has been very good. And OMSCO, who do the logistics of our milk, I think are making a very good job of it. They're regulating who comes in and how much milk is produced, and it's made a huge difference. And we're on a pretty good price.
So the future for organic milk in Scotland at the moment, from what you can tell,
I think it's quite good. I think it's quite good. The demand is on the upward, you know. And we know quite a lot of people who poo-poo organics and that, but quite a number of them admit for all that when they go to buy milk, they buy organic milk, you know. So that's got quite a good vibe, you know. I think it's quite positive. A bit worried about the Brexit job.
It seems there's a huge amount of uncertainty down south. About Brexit, the post-Brexit situation in terms of policy. Yeah. But I think up here I'm going to be talking a lot at the Highland Show about this tomorrow with people. There's that added uncertainty that actually, is agriculture even going to be devolved?
Whereas
at least at the moment, you've got a situation where Scotland's in control of farming within its borders.
Yeah.
We could be in a situation where we've actually got a UK policy set by Westminster that actually we've got a very similar basis of what we've got. It's just rather being set in Brussels. Mm. It's still being set. So I guess I'm asking, I'm assuming from your response there that you would prefer agriculture to continue to be devolved?
Definitely. I would prefer agricultural policies to come out of Brussels rather than Westminster. Mm. Westminster would be extremely bad crack. Mm. So, I mean, we'll be shouting for it, but it doesn't look too cheery at the moment, you know, we'd have to say.
You've seen the shift across the whole of the UK, really, gradually, I suppose, of an acceptance of, okay, even if our particular area didn't vote for Brexit, it's happening, we'll move on. Is that the case here?
Yeah, well, no, I don't know if it is.
There's still a hope that it can be overturned.
Well, there is a hope. I think it's a wee bit forlorn, but there is a hope. We still think that 62% of Scots voted, you know, to stay, so that's a reasonable amount. So I think we do feel a bit aggrieved, but well, we've felt aggrieved for generations, haven't we? You know, so I don't think there will be an upturn, but it'll be overturned. But
what's the future of the farm here? Keep doing the same thing?
Pretty much so. We have an advisor from Edinburgh who's been very good. He comes down once or twice a year. He's been coming since Winter Organic almost.
Oh, wow.
He's very good, yes, very good.
He's got a long relationship.
He keeps us on the straight and narrow. Well, as far as he knows, he keeps us on the straight and narrow. This time, I'm not as involved now because Sandy and Lucy run the business, but I usually go down when he comes, and he was here last week, and he said to me, this is the first time I've ever come down here where you haven't said to me, right, Ian, what are we going to be doing next? So maybe we haven't reached our zenith, I don't think. But I think the renewables thing has still got a wee bit to run. We're quite interested in doing something there.
Of course. Let's talk about that for a bit, because we haven't even mentioned the turbines. When did those go up?
We put the turbine in 2010... I think, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's been a good one. Yeah, it's been good. I'm sorry we never put a bigger one in. I'm sorry we never put more in. But we're testing the water then, you know.
Yeah. How did that go down locally in terms of planning? Were there any issues?
No, the planners, they never even came to see it. I think turbine came up. I think some of them maybe didn't even know what a turbine was, but not literally. There was absolutely no problem at all.
Yeah,
you know,
because
it just sailed through.
Mm.
I don't think there was one objection. A fellow in Dundee. Yes. He was a serial objector, but I think that's the only objection I was. Isn't that right?
I can't remember.
I think so.
That.
No, it went through fine. Yeah. We tried since, but no, we didn't. We had difficulty the next time.
As in the borders, in terms of onshore wind, what are the largest farms like?
There are some large farms. Mm. That just about every commercial wind farm that's been applied for local planning have turned it down. They've gone to the Scottish Government. The Scottish Government have passed it.
Okay.
Not in every case, but in quite a few.
Yeah. Because I know in the west of Scotland, certainly spending time over in Galloway and that sort of area, that's it causes huge, huge aggravation between people. And
there is now, yes. It's the same here now. Yes, it is. Yeah. Very much the same. Yeah.
Definitely divides.
It's changed, yeah. I mean, there is... We don't see a problem with them, obviously, but I think there is areas, I don't think maybe they should just be shot all over the place. There is areas that is good for turbines, and there's turbines there already. That's fair enough, I think they could be expanded upon. And there seem to be, there's still people keen to put turbines up. There's wind farms changing hands at a lot of money, so people must see, you know, a future in it.
Mm.
And I think there is, you know. We're, well, some days... Well, I mean, some days that we are overproducing power in Scotland, you know.
Mm.
And once the storage comes on song, which it will do, I think we'll be in a very good position.
Yeah. So your turbine on site, what does that power? Are you selling to the grid as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah.
So you can you can power everything that you need on farm.
Yeah.
That's success.
Obviously, there's times we have to import back, you know, when there's no wind. But if we could get a good connection again, get batteries on, we could sort that out. Mm. You know. We use about 65%, I think, and the rest goes down the lines of the grid, you know. So, no, it's been a good one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We've had, the turbines now, it's out of warranty, obviously, and, well, 20 years they were guaranteed feed-in tariffs for. I think a lot of these people, when the turbines started coming out, the idea was to get them on the market. If there's any problems with them, we'll sort them out as we go. The turbine we've had, we've got, actually, it's a good turbine. Unfortunately, the firm has gone bust, but there's still plenty of parts available, and it's not a bespoke turbine. It uses bits from, it's a German gearbox, it's a Canadian generator, so it's like an off-the-shelf job. It's going to cost us money to keep it going, I know that, but even so, it's going to be well worth it, yeah.
What would you say is the biggest challenge that Scottish farming faces over the next, say, 5 to 10 years, apart from Brexit? Because that opens up a whole new
line. For us, it's keeping ahead of all the legislation, I think, and all the form filling. We've got a bit of a diversification, so we're quite fortunate. I think for the likes of the ordinary whole farm and that, the next few years are going to be quite difficult, you know. I think there's going to be a downturn in subsidies, obviously, over the time. I think it's going to be hard. I think general agriculture will be hard unless you've got some other form of income you really need.
And in turn, we might see a reversion of more land to forestry.
Exactly. There's a big push on just now. There's quite a few of our neighbours planting quite a lot of trees. Yes.
Already?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we'll see that.
And quite a lot of others looking at it. Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Because I think what comes with any time of uncertainty is that at least there'll be certainty in the long term.
That's right.
It is a long term crop.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of the ground that they're planted trees on is quite, well, it's good ground. It's, dare I say, it's a bit too good for trees, we think. There are other ground where trees would go fine that it would be better suited, I think.
Mm.
From both points of view, from the tree people and from the agricultural people.
And around here, is it mostly your standard Sitka spruce? And
well, there's a bit of a turn away from that. Yeah. It is still, there's still an amount of Sitka. That's mostly in a kind of, in a bigger setup, you know. But aye, there's still Sitka, still, yeah.
Mm.
Still almost reigns supreme, but, yeah.
Mm. Thank you so much for... As I say, I think, for me, over Langshaw, really, it epitomises a lot of family farms on both sides of the border.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And actually, the fact that innovation, which is something that this podcast keeps on coming down to, it's about recognising what you can do, trying things out, not everything's going to work, but actually, when something does... you go for it, but also it's bloody hard graft at the same time.
But it's been enjoyable. Maybe should have got that over a bit.
Yeah.
The diversification things actually have been very enjoyable.
Yeah.
Because quite honestly, sometimes mainstream farming, it becomes a bit boring day to day, you know. And something else on the horizon, something else. It's been good. We've enjoyed it. I must say, we have enjoyed it.
Martin Burgess at Overlangshaw Farm. Next time, I will be at the Royal Highland Show, speaking to NFU Scotland's Lothian and Borders Regional Chairman Kelvin Pate, among others who are at the show. So I hope you can join me for that. Please do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and as always, you can listen to all previous episodes on thinkingcountry.com. I'll see you next time on Meet the Farmers.